Good morning, everyone. Thank you all for coming. Like all groups, the Haiti Working Group has a personality. And one aspect of the personality of the Haiti Working Group is that people don't RSVP, they just come. Which explains why we have a smaller room than we have people. But it happens all the time. Also, the other aspect of this group, which is kind of interesting, is that people come throughout. We were joking earlier that they wait until the speakers are finished and they show up. But you watch, and there'll be people drifting in an hour late, 90 minutes after the thing starts, people are coming. So it's, see? Yeah. Also, I have to warn you that that clock is really 5 minutes fast. This is USIP, and we're always ahead of ourselves. So. Anyway, it's great to have everyone here. The USIP Haiti Working Group began these public forums back in 2006 during the election, which eventually brought President Duvall to power. And we've been running these forums ever since. We took a break, and this is actually the first one of these that we've had in calendar 2008. But we hope to be back on track, and we hope to have one of these a month for the foreseeable future. The topic this morning is Haiti after the storms, weather and conflict. For those of you that watched McNeil Lair, the Lair News Hour last night, see how old I am. I remember when it was the McNeil Lair News Hour, but no longer. The Jim Lair News Hour last night, they had a report on Haiti after the storms, and it took USIP a lot of money to get them to use that title. But anyway, in September, you all know that a succession of four hurricanes and tropical storms, Faye, Gustave, Hannah, and Ike, hit Haiti. The destruction caused by these successive storms was devastating. Nearly 800 people were killed, thousands were injured, hundreds of thousands of families were displaced, crops, roads, and bridges were destroyed, and millions were put at risk of starvation. The damage due to infrastructure was so great that there are still parts of Haiti now that can only really reach by helicopters and boats. The impact of these storms halted Haiti's steady economic progress. President Duvall has said that the storms set back Haiti's economic development by several years. International aid officials have warned that the economic consequences of the storms were so dire that they could spark the kind of food riots that erupted in Haiti earlier this year. After the storms, the United Nations, the World Bank, donor countries, local governments, and citizen groups offered recovery assistance. The UN issued a formal appeal for $108 million. The World Bank offered $25 million in additional aid. The US pledged $29 million in new storm assistance. The US also sent the USS Kearsarge, which used its helicopters and landing craft to ferry 3.3 million pounds of food, water, and medical relief, plus to the hardest hit and otherwise inaccessible parts of Haiti. Private citizens, rock stars, NGOs, local governments, and the diaspora contributed assistance. School boards in Broward and other South Florida districts made well-publicized offers to make classrooms, mobile classrooms, available to help schools reopen. At the same time, critics argue that the level of international response to the Haiti crisis paled in relationship to the need and in comparison to the assistance which was provided to Central America after Hurricane Mitch. And these people argued that the international community must do more. On October 23rd, World Bank President Robert Zoellick completed a three-day visit to Haiti. Zoellick warned that Haiti was, quote, at a tipping point, and massive assistance was required. Zoellick's visit was followed by an editorial in the Miami Herald, which said, and I'll quote, Haiti could fall into a bottomless pit of hunger, disease, crime, poverty, and desperation that will make the preceding decade of poverty, violence, and instability look benign by comparison. Zoellick's visit and efforts by the United States will be the central topic of our discussion this morning, which will focus on the situation in Haiti and the international response and the challenges faced by Haiti's new government. As usual, for these sessions, we have a very distinguished panel. Ivan Chikata is the country director for the Caribbean at the World Bank. Did you go with Bob Zelig?
Yes,
you did. Okay, so this is a first-hand report of what Bob Zelig and his team saw in Haiti. Joseph Tillman, who is, I think, new to the Caribbean Affairs Office in the Department of State, is with us this morning. And Bob McGuire, who's an old friend of ours, who was the director of the Haiti program at Trinity College, but is now this year a Jennings Randolph Fellow at USIP. And so we'll be seeing a lot of Bob. When the panel completes its presentations, I'm going to ask Haiti's ambassador to the United States, Raymond Joseph, who's with us this morning, to say a few words. And I'm also going to invite Maureen Taft-Morales from the Congressional Research Service, who's just finished a paper on this subject, to talk about congressional attitudes and how these things look from the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, as they say. So if it's all right with everybody, we'll just begin. Yvonne, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Bob. I want to thank USIP for this invitation and this opportunity. Can you hear me in the back? I'm just recovering from laryngitis, so can't scream as I normally do. Okay? All right. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I look forward to our discussion. It's very timely, as you just referenced. We just got back from Haiti. I was there for a week. Mr. Zelig was there for 3 days. We had initially thought he might cancel on us, given everything else that's going on, but he was very interested and very eager to actually visit Haiti. This was the first trip by World Bank President to Haiti in 10 years. The last visit was by President Wilkinson in 95, actually more than 10 years. So this was quite an important visit from our perspective. And I'll get into a little bit, you know, a little bit of what he did as I talk. This audience probably doesn't need any reminder of the very difficult combination of events that Haiti has experienced this year. In addition to having had the worst recent hurricane season that you referenced, we obviously still have the specter of the food prices, energy prices, which thankfully are coming down, and the associated political and social unrest. The current situation remains very challenging along several dimensions, and I'll talk through some of these. The first is the reconstruction efforts. The second is the macroeconomic situation. The third is protecting the vulnerable. And then finally, how, as development partners, we mobilize ourselves to work with the Haitian authorities. Thank you. In terms of the reconstruction effort, I'm glad you referenced Hurricane Mitch, because this is really what we're looking at. The magnitude of the reconstruction effort is unprecedented. When we went to Gonaï, we were told that it would take 3 years just to clear the mud out of the city. We had a joint damage needs assessment mission out there. It's a joint mission with the United Nations, the European Union, and the Inter-American Development Bank. They're just completing their work, which they will discuss with the authorities, but preliminary estimates indicate that we're looking at up to about 15% of GDP. This is quite devastating. In terms of damage in sectors, the most affected sectors are obviously housing, transport, and in terms of employment, it's pretty much all across the board, but obviously the Rice Valley, those areas with a lot of agriculture, heavily affected. In terms of a preliminary indication of post-disaster strategic priorities, I think there are four areas that we're looking at. The first is food security and livelihood recovery. The second is basic services and connectivity, rehabilitation, reconstruction. Third is the productive sectors, and the fourth is the restoration of the environment. So these are sort of the main areas. As you can see, it's almost pretty much across the board. And the scope of the response will need to reflect that accordingly. Let me turn a little bit to the economic context. And I want to take us back to the first quarter of this year, where Haiti was doing quite well. The economy had stabilized, inflation was pretty low, and essentially you saw a recovery from the shocks of 2004 when you had political turmoil and floods and all of that. GDP growth was 3.2% in FY 2007, and it was the third successive year of expansion. So you actually saw an upward path. And if you looked at the projections that we and others had, it looked pretty good. Now clearly, and this is very similar to Hurricane Jean in 2004, what's happened is each time you have these shocks, Haiti's getting bumped to a lower development path. Inflation has more than doubled. Right now estimated at close to 19%. The growth estimates have obviously come down. We don't have the full estimate of the impact on growth, but clearly there's a bit of uncertainty on private sector confidence, and we're expecting that both domestic and foreign direct investment will be lower than originally expected. The damage to infrastructure and agriculture are obviously severe, and the fiscal performance in the last fiscal year has been characterized by lower than anticipated revenues and, of course, the unanticipated emergency spending. Our colleagues over at the fund estimate that there's a sizable financing gap, could be up to $100 million, dollars. And that will obviously need to be filled through additional external support or a significant fiscal adjustment, which I'm sure we can all appreciate is hard to do in the current context. Now, despite all these shocks, the government has actually done a very good job of maintaining overall stability. It hasn't gone haywire, but one obviously knows that this is a very difficult time for them, and the more external support that Haiti can get, the easier it will be for them to stay the path. So that's sort of where we see the economic context. In terms of the most vulnerable, one of the things that was very striking throughout the year is the real weakness on safety nets. And I can contrast it with some of the other countries in the Caribbean, let's say Jamaica, where we have a pretty good safety net program, where we're able to target the lowest deciles in terms of poverty. And so, for example, when the food prices increased, we were immediately able to put additional money through a conditional cash transfer program that we have that's linked to school attendance and nutrition. And we were able to essentially increase by 40-50% the number of families and households we were targeting. We don't have such a system in Haiti. What we have is a number of individual interventions like school feeding, like food for work through the WFP, etc. And this is an area that we feel going forward, in order to have a safety net that's smarter, that's targeting the appropriate people and the right people, that is those who are most vulnerable, we need to do a lot more work. And we're working with the government of Haiti on this, providing some technical assistance this year to design a more comprehensive safety net program that would look at nutrition and that would allow families to maintain their investment in the human capital of their children. But this is clearly a gap right now in the government's ability to respond. At the same time, we're very sensitive to some of the views of the Haitian government, particularly President Preval, that one needs to be careful that this does not become some kind of a dependency approach. And we fully concur with him. And I think this is why it's so important that whatever safety nets we put in place be linked to things that families actually want to invest in, whether it's their children's education or whether it's nutrition in early childhood, which we know has impact way beyond the early childhood years. Let me turn to what the bank is doing. We were on the ground pretty early at the request of the Haitian Ministry of Public Works. We were there in the first week of September to evaluate the damage to the country's transportation infrastructure.
And we complemented the work that the Bank Finance Civil Protection Committees have been doing, as well as the community-driven councils. And we provided a preliminary picture of the scope of damages and losses. Subsequently, in response to a request from the Ministry of Finance, the bank hosted Global Facility for Disaster Risk Reduction, mobilized the joint mission that I just referred to. And this mission is in conjunction with the European Commission, the United Nations, and the Inter-American Development Bank. And the team has just completed, I think it was a three-week trip there, and they are looking at these damages and losses and identifying the recovery and reconstruction needs. I know they're having discussions with the government right now, and I expect that pretty soon the government will come out with a statement on this, and there will be a call through the callable fund facility of this operation. In addition, for the bank proper, Bob Zelik already announced $25 million in additional World Bank support. This comprises a $20 million IDA emergency recovery grant to Haiti, and it will support bridge reconstruction, infrastructure rehabilitation, and importantly, technical assistance on disaster mitigation and preparedness in the future. Because I think this going forward, this is an important part of the puzzle. If you compare what Haiti just experienced to 2004 with Hurricane Jean, where the storm was not as devastating in terms of wind speed, flooding, and all of that, but you had many more lives lost, clearly you can see that in the communities where there has been some disaster preparedness, they were able to move people out more effectively, more quickly. And so it's very hard to sort of look on the bright side given the current situation, but there is a bright side in the sense that some things did work. And the question is, how can we ramp that up and how can we continue that? It's very hard to ask development partners to come in with additional support if, you know, everything that they're investing in, everything the government's investing is going to be washed away 2 years and we're going to be sitting here at USIP again. So I think this whole notion of how does the country continue to strengthen its disaster preparedness is a big part of the actions going forward. In addition, for this emergency operation that I mentioned, the $20 million, we're processing this under emergency procedures, which means 6 weeks from start to finish. Those of you who know the bank are probably saying, that's not possible, but it is possible. And we'll be going to the board November 18th. In addition, we have a $5 million grant to rehabilitate rural water and sanitation. We will be doing additional financing for two of our existing projects. One is an education project where we'll be putting in an additional, I believe, $5 million to help rebuild schools. And we will also be putting additional financing through our existing community-driven development projects in the rural areas. Gonaive was one of the areas where we had communities that were beneficiaries of this project, and we would like to help them get back. And for those who are not familiar with this project, it really is from the ground up. The communities identify the types of projects that they would like to see funded. They have their own governance structure. And I think it's a quick way to hear from the communities directly about what they need. More globally, we're in the process of designing our new country assistance strategy. We obviously need to take into account the new priorities that have arisen, given the events of this year, such as agriculture, while taking into account what other donors, many of whom are much bigger than us, such as the U.S. and Canada and the IDB, taking into account what they're doing. In terms of areas of focus, we will continue with efforts to show quick wins. We will continue with efforts to scale up what's working. Education has been a big area of focus for us. We expect that will continue, much as we expect community-driven development projects to continue, and also what we've been doing on the public sector in terms of strengthening capacity and institutions. In terms of moving forward, it's early days yet, but what we heard from the Haitian authorities last week is that they would like to look towards a donor conference early next year, sometime in January. And I think what we're hearing from fellow partners is that this timing is good. We all would like it to be earlier, but we have to be realistic. But I think it's very timely. Obviously, as development partners, we never had a chance to discuss the poverty reduction strategy with the government. But the government itself feels that all of this now has to be re-looked at in the context of the crisis, because we do have a major reconstruction effort in front of us. And so one needs to look again at the priorities. The other thing is, the sense I got is, and anyone who's looked at the poverty reduction strategy knows this, is that there are quite a number of priorities, and there is, I think, a sense that we need to focus it a bit more. You know, maybe pick three areas that really one can move on very quickly in the next 18 months to really show some progress. I think the other one, and this is probably a more personal view, is I feel we really need to change the narrative on Haiti. One of the things that struck me when I was in Haiti last week, and I was very impressed by this, from the president on down, there wasn't really a sense of being a victim or, you know, obviously people are shaken by the events, but they want to move ahead. Haitians want to move ahead. They've been extremely resilient. And I think we need to figure out how we can help Haiti grow, for example. I'll just give you one example, the HOPE 2 Act. This is a wonderful opportunity for Haiti. There are not too many countries that are just an hour and a half from the U.S. Our private sector arm, the IFC, has made a lot of investments in Haiti. They've ramped up their activities in the last 2 years, focusing on the financial sector, infrastructure, textiles, and the investment climate. And I think that's an area where there are some quick wins, whether you talk about land titling, property rights, getting stuff through the ports. You know, in another life, I worked in Southern Africa where they benefited a lot from AGOA. And all it takes is two or three companies to get in there and make those investments and create employment. So I think in addition to what needs to happen on the reconstruction side, we really also need to look at the positive side of what are the opportunities and what needs to happen for those opportunities to actually happen. Probably gone on a little bit longer than I should have. Just want to close by saying Haiti really faces a challenging environment. The World Bank's experience in fragile states such as Haiti calls for long-term and sustained commitment on the part of the international community. We need predictable financing, and this is really a critical point. When we talk about fragile states, we're not talking about a three-year country strategy. You really have to be in it for 10 years, 20 years. That's what it took in Mozambique, that's what it took in Rwanda, that's what it took in Uganda, and that's what it will take in Haiti. The bank is eager, obviously, to be a partner with Haiti in this process, but I think together, we really, various partners, we need to work together with Haiti on this, and we have to stay the course. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
You're on.
Okay, thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Joe Tillman. I'm the Haiti Desk Officer at the Office for Caribbean Affairs at the U.S. Department of State. Just a minor amendment to Bob's introductory remarks. I was a Haiti Desk Officer in the dark days of early 2004. That was about the end of my two-year stint, which began in 2002, and saw the end of President Aristide's presidency and his subsequent exit to other countries. And I was listening to Yvonne and thinking about how I might couch my remarks today. And, you know, I was struck by what she said at the end about being positive here and seeing what opportunities there are out there to address the strengths of Haiti, the first of which I would say is the resilience and strength of its people. you know, enterprising, I think engaged in their own political future, according to all the reporting that I have seen. You really get a sense that here is a people that want to succeed, that want to make their country a better place, and what I see the United States government doing in partnership with our partners in the international community, both the international financial institutions and our bilateral partners, is working on those strengths. We have a lot to do. I think Yvonne has properly characterized this situation, and I'm going to, in just a minute, I'm going to go through some materials here. There is a lot to do. It depends on who you talk to, but I've heard numbers. The total bill for rehabilitation running from $550 million up to $1.2 billion. So I don't think any of us who are here today can entertain any illusions about the difficulty of the road that we face, but given the engagement that I have seen, both on behalf of our government and other governments in the international financial institutions, I have to say I'm basically optimistic that we can deal with this, bring Haiti back to a kind of a baseline economic level so that it can continue the progress that it has shown over the last few years that Yvonne mentioned. I'm going to give you a sense of what I think are the four or five priorities going forward. But before I do that, I wanted to share, and I'm sorry, Bob, I didn't have time.
That's okay.
To make copies of these,
but
I'm going to pass these around, and the first one I want to is a satellite photo of Gonaïves, which will give you an extent, or give you a very good idea of the extent of the damage that was caused by the movement of mud and other debris from the upper watershed area through Gonaïves. When you look at this picture, you will see where the town is located, but this entire area around here is covered in 4 or 5 feet of mud. And we had some engineers at the Kearsarge who were out there looking at this, and the guy had been in the construction business and told us that if he had 10 big dump trucks working 365 days a year, doing 10 loads a day, it would take 2 years to clean up the city. There is a question here about the viability, the continued viability of this city. I think that it's going to be one of the most difficult issues in reconstruction that we're going to have to face. I don't think any Haitian, given Gonaïves' historical importance to the country, would want to abandon it wholesale, but something's going to have to be done, I think, especially about upper watershed management, which is a critical part of what we have to do in reconstruction. But this will give you a pretty good idea. There are some other items here that USAID has produced to show the hurricane tracks, and there are also finally some photos of Port de Paix that were taken by the Miami City Council went down to visit and develop these photos. And Port de Paix wasn't even one of the areas that was hit all that hard, but you can see the extent of the dislocation. That there's a picture here of the main street that's covered with debris and garbage that has not, or at least at the time the photo was taken, hasn't been cleaned up, and I think we all understand what the health risks are there, how much work it takes to deal with this before we can get back to that economic baseline on which we can start to rise again after the shock of these storms. So I'm just going to hand these, you know, and people are free to make copies if they want. I don't want to spend a lot of my remarks telling you what the United States government has done. What I have done, and this is available publicly on USAID's website, is bring a hard copy of the latest fact sheet Now, I've only got 15, but we can make as many of these as you want. It will tell you what the United States government has done from the time that the storm set.
Can you give a copy to
the secretary? Sure.
Why don't you give her the whole thing?
Give her the whole thing.
Put them on the table, people
okay.
can pick them up when they leave, and we'll have
right.
enough for everybody.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's
all right. No, we were all late this morning. So.
Yeah, okay. But in any event, the fact sheet will show the basics. Up to this point, we've devoted $31.6 million in emergency commodities. I think it was Yvonne or Bob made reference to the U.S. Navy Kearsarge, which was there for 19 days, delivering millions of tons of food commodities. We also had two or three Coast Guard cutters doing the same. Another highlight moving forward in terms of what the United States government is doing, the continuing resolution set aside $100 million for hurricane recovery in the Caribbean, most of which is going to be spent in Haiti. We think that the way things look now, I mean, we're engaged in internal governmental deliberations that are going to determine how we're going to spend these funds in coordination with our other partners and given the priorities that we all identify. But it looks as if it'll be $97 million moving forward, and we hope more. Let me just begin by saying, going back to what I was saying at the beginning when I previously was a desk officer for Haiti, and how dark the situation looked when President Aristide resigned and left the country. We began a very uncertain period in Haiti's history. At that time, fortunately stabilized with first the multilateral interim force, followed by MINUSTA. And as I was saying earlier, and as a personal aside, optimism is the stock and trade of diplomats in some respects. I mean, they have to be in order to produce a result that provides a resolution of a conflict or a way out of a particularly difficult humanitarian situation such as what we have in Haiti. But comparing the two experiences from my own point of view between 2004 and now, I've been very gladdened by what I have seen in terms of our engagement and the engagement of the international community. So let me just identify what I think are a series of priorities moving forward. Robust bilateral assistance. The indications are that our international partners who work with us in Haiti are stepping up to the plate in a very real sense to help the country. The EU, the Canadians, the U.S., I think we can identify as being the principal donors, but we are expecting, as we move forward with the donor process, and it will be one of our priorities to engage others in an effort to provide the kind of robust bilateral assistance that Haiti is going to need. Partners that we hope to engage are Japan, hopefully the EU, if we can work within the European Commission procedures to move assistance along, we would like to do that. All we hope culminating in the donor conference that Yvonne mentioned, that the Haitian government has indicated they want to host, sometime before Carnival, which I'm not sure when Easter is this year, but I think it's before the end of February. So, you know, we're looking forward to that. So there are a lot of players. It's not just the bilateral donors. It's also our partners in the international financial institutions. And a key issue here is going to be donor coordination. As I speak, there are and will be meetings with our World Bank partners soon between USAID and the World Bank to discuss the bank's plans for their disaster recovery facility, how we can bring all these various efforts together in order to provide the most efficient assistance the fastest. This is going to be a key element going forward that all of us are going to have to work on. At the Haiti Key Players Group meeting on the margins of the UN General Assembly, donor coordination was an issue that was raised on several occasions, most notably by our Latin American partners who have contributed troops to MINUSTA. So I think everybody knows that we need to do this. Do we need to do it better? Probably. But the problem is large. There's going to be, we hope, sufficient assets to address them. And making sure that we're all working together in the most efficient way possible is going to be very important. Another priority for us, political support for the new government, Michel Pierre-Louis. Indications that we have are that she's getting good cooperation from the parliament, but and that the neediest people, to a large extent, have been reached with the kind of emergency assistance that they needed in the short term. However, as Yvonne mentioned, food security is a big issue here, and this it isn't going to go away. Both in terms of providing alimentary support for people in the short term and working on recovery of the agricultural sector, which there are various percentages bandied about, but a substantial proportion of this growing season is now gone. In looking at scenarios going forward, it's not too difficult to see as what happened in April 2008, that food shortages will lead to the kind of popular discontent that erupted at that time, and which could be a very destabilizing element for Michel Pierre-Louis' government as she moves forward with President Preval in working with the international community on Haiti's recovery. We think it's important, both from that point of view and from the humanitarian point of view, that we get the assistance in as soon as we can, and the administration will be doing whatever it can to express support for Michel Pierre-Louis. We're trying to get her to come up. She thus far has told us that she's much too busy, not hard to understand that. But when she does come, we're going to see to it that she gets to the highest levels possible. So that's an important element for us. Let me mention extended engagement of the international community, another point that Yvonne raised. I might even go further out than 10 or 20 years to have the international community engaged in some senses. The nature of that engagement may change as we stabilize the situation, get economic, get hurricane damages repaired, get the economic situation going on an uptrend again. So I think right now we're heading for a fairly intensive period of international community engagement. Hopefully, as the situation improves, the nature of that engagement will change. But I will say this. We, as I think probably everybody else here, recognizes the invaluable contribution that MINUSTAH has made in providing a security umbrella for Haiti. At a minimum, we see them being there through the next presidential electoral cycle, which would be 2011, and a peaceful transfer of power following, you know, free and fair elections. Those of us who were at the Key Players Group meeting know that our Latin American partners who are contributing troops are interested in altering MINUSTAH's mandate a little bit away from a strictly security mandate to something more developmental. Now, that may be down the line, but it's very apparent that the security umbrella that MINUSTAH provides, given what happened and what can happen when these kinds of exogenous shocks hit Haiti, that the hurricanes hit. I don't think there's any question that MINUSTAH's logistical support and its presence to provide security probably was a key element in getting us through the acute humanitarian crisis part of this. So in terms of international community engagement, I think we'll need to be flexible moving forward. I think, you know, we will need to keep MINUSTAH engaged and keep renewing its mandate, even though it may change as time goes forward. So that's a critical element for us. On the economic side, we need to try to, to keep the HIPC process as on track and on time as we can. The debt relief that will provide, I think, would be critical for Haiti's prospects for sustainable economic development. The latest review, I guess, was September? And there's going to be another one soon, so we're all hoping that will stay on track and that we can get to completion point. That would be important. I want to touch briefly on HOPE 2. HOPE 1 passed in 2006, I believe it was a great opportunity, but had rules of textile origin that were a little bit on the restrictive side, at least in the view of some of the observers. And although the substantial bulk of Haiti's textile exports to the United States occurred under HOPE 1, as we called it, HOPE 2006, it still didn't come anywhere near the cap that the legislation provided. So there is a tremendous opportunity here. HOPE 2, which passed as part of the Farm Bill earlier this year, does liberalize the textile rules of origin in a complicated fashion that I'm not sure I could explain clearly. But it suffice it to say that those liberalized rules have engendered the interest, for example, of the Brazilians, who have now indicated, and they did at the Key Players Group meeting, and have also indicated to us bilaterally, that they are interested in investments under HOPE 2. They expressed the desire for some more liberalized textile rules of origin, but I don't think that's a realistic possibility moving forward. Nonetheless, there are various estimates to the number of jobs that the first HOPE legislation provided, but I've seen 5,000 to 7,000, and they use less than 2% of the cap. So there is a tremendous opportunity here once we get the hurricane damage fixed and we get some direct foreign investors like the Brazilians and probably the Chinese as well will be coming in to make investments under HOPE 2. I've probably gone over,
So anyway, thanks very much, and we'll get back to you.
Okay.
You want to bring us home? I have to say that our friend Bob McGuire is a devoted and very devout Philadelphia Phillies fan. The rumor is spreading around the Institute this morning that he has decided to maintain a vigil now that the game was suspended last night because of rain in the fifth inning, and he has vowed not to sleep until the game resumes and Philadelphia wins the series tonight. So,
thank you, Bob. I was going to wear red in celebration, but couldn't pull that off. Yvonne and Joe said so much that I wanted to say that I'll just kind of cherry pick some of my comments to complement or underscore some of what they've mentioned. 2008, although 2007 was positive, 2008 in Haiti was shaping up as a problematic year. With the aforementioned demonstrations against the high cost of living that led to rock throwing and property damage and death, and the sacking of the prime minister, all this before the storm. And I think it's worth noting that when the prime minister, Alexei, was sacked in early, mid-April, a donors meeting that had been planned for late April was unfortunately had to be postponed. We've heard mention of a donors meeting now for perhaps early 2009. I think this is an essential step. I think it was also mentioned that President Preval is coming toward the mid part of his term with presidential elections coming for 2010. And like the U.S., Haiti tends to move into presidential election mode quite early. So this also has some bearing on what you see in terms of the political developments in Haiti. And I think, again, another development taking place before the onslaught of the storms is the fact that empirical data and anecdotal data started to show that remittances were becoming stagnant and perhaps even dropping. And this, of course, is something that's very important, a flow of approximately $1.6 billion a year, I think the latest estimates, something that really helps to keep patients' heads above water. I might argue that there are several silver linings here, and I'm glad that we have some optimism from the other speakers as well. And I think the storms brought one major silver lining immediately in that they led to the ratification of Michel Pierre-Louis, who was actually ratified as Ike bore down on the island. This ended months of ambiguity, political ambiguity, and the inability of the government to move forward on new programs. The new prime minister is respected. She's smart. She's experienced. She's apolitical. She works toward inclusion. And she has tremendous experience working with the poor and with Haiti's youthful population, and it's worth mentioning that Haiti is an incredibly youthful population with at least, let's say, 40% or so 15 years or younger. Also, when her government was ratified, it's worth noting that a coalition in governance continued. It was maintained. Seven of the eight ministers in her cabinet are carryovers from the Alexis government, including, I think most importantly, the Minister of Plan, who was critical in the poverty reduction strategy. Some would say that her ratification was the result of an act of God. Others would say that the protagonists who were stalling the ratification process were somewhat embarrassed or pressured into taking actions. I believe it's a bit of both. We could speculate that had the storms not hit, Haiti could still be without a prime minister. Many analysts have called Haiti's storms unnatural disasters, and I just want to explore this for a minute, including Paul Farmer, for example, who knows Haiti very well. And I think if we look at the genesis of this, it might help to inform a little bit our response to Haiti. I would argue, as others have, that in the past 30 years or so, international investment in Haiti has been much more focused on urban development in Haiti. 30 years ago, Haiti was being addressed as coming to be the Taiwan of the Caribbean, its location, cheap labor, and so on. And so there was a great emphasis on this kind of development, and indeed, somewhere between 60 to 80,000 assembly jobs were created in the early 80s. But there was no real corresponding rural investment in Haiti, as there had been in Taiwan, incidentally, where agricultural agrarian reform, improved production, building the rural infrastructure matched the idea of making Taiwan into Taiwan. None of that occurred in Haiti. In fact, the countryside was pretty much neglected, and what occurred was a very large migration toward the cities and outside of Haiti, as people engaged in what Haitians call chercher la vie, or looking for life. That migration to the urban areas, which was massive, also settled immigrants in very vulnerable areas. And we've seen the results of that this year with the storms. People forced to live in river deltas, on alluvial floodplains, by riverbanks, on urban hillsides, and threatening the environment, damaging the environment further. And further, that migration to the bright lights and hopes of the city was unfulfilled for many migrants. It's estimated that of every five who migrated to Port-au-Prince in the 1980s looking for a job, only two of them found it. So here we have slums expanding considerably, leading to instability and stress. In the countryside, where there was a neglect of investment, you had heightened desperation and people mortgaging their future, which included increased harvesting of vegetation cover, as wood and charcoal demands in the growing cities called for more and more energy from the increasingly denuded hillsides. So as today, USAID estimates, the last one I saw, Haiti has about 1.5% of its hillsides covered in vegetation. Fueling the migration as well and enabling it to occur was the fact that Haiti was the beneficiary in the 1970s and 80s, mostly 80s, of very cheap imported food, particularly rice, what Haitians were calling Miami rice, coming in and undercutting the price of locally produced rice to the point where Haiti's rice industry virtually collapsed. Well, all was fine and good as long as the food was cheap, but as we've seen now, it's no longer cheap. And Haiti is very much behind the eight ball when it comes to this entire issue of food insecurity. The Haitian National Committee for Food Security, the CNSA, estimates today that 3.3 million Haitians are in either moderate or severe food insecurity. That's roughly a third of Haiti's population, a bit less than that. And just to put it in context, imagine if in the United States after Katrina, 100 million Haitian Americans were in vulnerable food security conditions. We would consider that to be quite a crisis, I would say. So this kind of evolution over 30 years of the tendency of where investments were and where they were not led to a perfect storm, not only for the damage from the hurricanes, but also for the cost of living crisis. Now, I'm not going to argue that hope is not important, and obviously jobs are a very important part of the equation. One would love to see that investment decentralized to the extent possible, but I think also it's time to eclipse the focus on hope as the principal pillar and readjust that focus, I think, to rural development and not just farming, but all the kind of jobs, artisanal jobs, community jobs that can come along with that. In terms of responses that have been made, I think Joe and Yvonne have been very comprehensive in that. I would just mention a couple of things. Mitch was brought up. And in the aftermath of Mitch, one of the responses from the U.S. government was to offer people from the afflicted countries temporary protected status. This has not been offered to Haitians. I think it should be offered to Haitians. Suspend the deportations. The deportations have been suspended. But the TSP enables people to work and find jobs. And if they can find jobs, even in our deteriorating economy, this means that more money will go back to Haiti where it's desperately needed. I think one of the silver linings we see, another one perhaps in the storm, is the solidarity that Haitian Americans and many Americans have shown to Haiti, responding with relief supplies. And in Haiti, I think it's very remarkable that we've seen a kind of solidarity among Haitians. And this is not something you see all that often. Of course, this is short term. One wouldn't expect these kind of fundraisings and so on to go beyond the short term, but they are important in the short term. They should be applauded and recognized. But I was very impressed by President Zulich's call for midterm and long-term solutions and not what he called hit-and-run solutions. But I was not very happy with the whole idea that debt cancellation for Haiti will not be considered. I would hope that it might be considered. I think that canceling Haiti's debt would somewhat go against our adage of being penny wise and pound foolish. I think the government of Haiti needs all its energy and resources on relief, not on servicing debt. Haiti's debt is $1.7 billion, $540 million to the World Bank. It has $554 million debt service per year, roughly $1 million a month. Obviously, those funds could be put to better use in Haiti. Responses in Haiti, I think, need to be underscored as well. I'm very happy that both of our speakers have been talking about the importance of working with the government of Haiti. And I think that is something that needs to be underscored. This is a legitimate government. It's a democratically elected government. And I think, as we heard from other speakers, it has the answers in mind. It needs the help to pursue them. President Preval has called for investment beyond relief. He has questioned the food aid and charitable paradigm, stating, I quote here, charity has never helped any country get out of underdevelopment. And he is concerned that Haiti will be forgotten, eclipsed by larger issues once immediate relief occurs. And sadly, he may be correct. There are many crises in the world, and our international responders tend to be peripatetic and pulled in many different directions. It is, I think, extremely important to make that long-term commitment. But the fact that there has not been a response in the magnitude after Mitch was to Haiti, I think that's a warning sign that Haiti could very well be forgotten. But I think it's in the interest of the international community not to forget Haiti and not to offer just palliatives. We saw the problems in the 2004. And then even just earlier this year, we saw that MINUSTAH was able to help with that security umbrella to keep Haiti moving forward. But I think with some of the challenges in food security and continued rise of prices that are confronting Haiti right now, protests against that may be beyond MINUSTAH's control if Haiti is not helped in a very serious and sustained way. I think that, just mention one or two other things. I've been very impressed by the work of the National Committee for Food Security, CNSA, in Haiti. And it has developed a list of 7 key priorities for securing Haiti's future, ranging from improved physical infrastructure, food and animal production, watershed rehabilitation, and mitigating against malnutrition health by improving health, water, and sanitation services. I think that the government of Haiti has shown its commitment to this by pledging, by allocating $198 million of its funds available through the Petro-Caribe allocation and pledging $56 million of those funds to help to rehabilitate agriculture. It needs roughly double that to replace the crops swept away by storms. We do have a dilemma of, I think it was mentioned earlier, that you try growing crops and then you get another flood and your investment is yet washed away again. So this will need an integrated approach, and I would put environmental rehabilitation very, very high on the list. I'll stop there because I think I've used up my time. And
thank you very much. I'd like to say that we're very honored this morning by the presence of Haiti's ambassador to the United States, Renaud Joseph, who is with us today, and I'd like to invite him to say a few words. Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you very much. I was listening very closely, and one thing that hit me, I wanted to ask, why do you think the safety net. The safety net that was there in Jamaica and not in Haiti. And I would say one of the reasons for that
is probably because in Jamaica, you've been working with government, with the government, to set up this thing. And in Haiti, for the past 20 years, the emphasis has been, and we have all reasons for that, with NGOs. And almost, I don't know the percentages, the government is pretty sensitive about that. The percentage of the aid given to Haiti is given to NGOs. And I'm quite sure in Jamaica, the reason why a safety net was there was probably because you work with government. And I would suggest that what has begun now within the democratic government be intensified in various areas because NGOs cannot really develop a country. As far as priorities for us right now, the emergency priorities, President Preval has made very clear it's to take care of the population as soon as possible. And he's been here in the U.S., at the U.N. since the hurricanes. He's been in Miami twice. And I was surprised to see the president canceling his trip back to Haiti just to go see on the ground prefab housing or portable schools in Broward County, which has donated 600 units to Haiti. And each unit will hold about 40 students. The latest thing in this is that the president says we have to do something right away before Christmas to give the people some hope. And just yesterday, a camp that was built to in proximity to the new American embassy, in fact, the camp was built for the workers that were building the embassy. That camp came from Houston, Texas. It was built for 322 Americans with gymnasium, restaurants, and so forth. Now, as of yesterday, discussions, I think, came to fruition that that camp, which was going to be dismantled and perhaps taken to Panama or Dominican Republic, will stay in Haiti. And not probably, but will be shifted to one of the areas, I cannot say which one yet, perhaps Cabaret, perhaps Gonaïves. But at least people will see this as something coming. And in the meantime, we are working with barges to get barges to bring in all these donated portable schools and portable buildings to Haiti. That was done with the camp that went to build the American embassy. It came from Houston. If you look at it, it's just like a little city. Until we can build some solid housing, I think Haiti needs some help to do that immediately. As far as Gonaïves, as Mr. Tillman said, we have to think about, perhaps abandoning the city or relocating it. It's not only Gonaïves. Haiti has two major cities that are below sea level. And that's the main problem with Gonaïves. Kai and Gonaïves. Mm-hmm. Gonaïves is worse because Gonaïves is like in a bowl. And the waters come from the hillside and the water comes from the sea. So I think in the long run, dredging of the port of Gonaïves has to be done and rerouting of the rivers away from the city has to be taken care of. But in the long run, I hear that you talk about 20 years involvement or engagement. I hope it stays 20 years. I hope the people don't forget Haiti very quickly. And in those 20 years, we should have a big project of reforestation. If that is not done, Haiti probably will not exist. The problems of Haiti deforestation didn't happen overnight. It began with the colonization of Haiti and has continued with the international community getting the precious wood out of Haiti first. The cathedrals and major buildings in Europe replete with Haitian hardwood. So it's not today that this started. It continued with even in religious campaign in the 40s when, I'm not throwing stones, but the Catholic Church started a big campaign of converting the voodooists. And the mapu tree is the biggest tree in Haiti. That's where the spirits lived, supposedly. And the mapu trees had to be cut down throughout Haiti. It happens also under the Duvaliers, when they had to cut a swath of about 3 kilometers between Dominican Republic and Haiti so that rebels would not come across. So when you come from Dominican Republic to Haiti, you can see where the green stops and the brown starts. So all these things I'm saying about reforestation is important, and it continued with the charcoal and all that. We have to come with alternative fuels, because just offering the telling the people to plant trees, there has been a lot of reforestation programs in Haiti. But if you don't give them an incentive not to cut the trees, you continue to cut them. We have seen some reforestation in South Haiti where the trees are fruit trees, like mango trees, avocado trees. They're not going to cut them down because the mango trees represent an investment. So I am pleading for long-term engagement in Haiti, and for us to do the basic work and to end up with what Bob Maguire has said here, we cannot just concentrate on Port-au-Prince, the Republic of Port-au-Prince, or even the major cities. We have to start a program of decentralization. And since Hope Act was mentioned, I don't want to tap myself on the back, but this was what I thought was a major thing when I came here in 2004. Haiti should be back in business. When we got Hope Act number one, only for 3 years, with a lot of restrictions, Charlie Rangel said to me, "Take it, Ray, take it. When we come in, we'll enlarge it." He's done so. We have hope now for 10 years with fewer restrictions. And I'm asking all the friends of Haiti to help us to bring in the investment. In the meantime, we're working on the security. And you have to admit, the government has done, I wouldn't say a marvelous job, but a pretty good job. Because in the past, what has happened to Haiti now would have caused a breakdown in government. There has not been any breakdown in government because President Préval has worked in a way to stabilize Haiti by opening the country to the spirit of reconciliation and the spirit of unity, because that was the motto that gave us independence. L'union fait la force. In unity, there is strength. We're going to try to fortify that more. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And your mention of Charlie Rangel is a natural segue into our next meeting. From the Nuclear Echo Research Service, there's a short concise view of the things like from Capitol Hill.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Bob just asked me last night to do this, so I've kind of pulled together some thoughts. I just finished a report Haiti post-hurricane conditions and assistance. So I brought a few copies here that I can leave. And sorry, if you don't have a website, you have to get it from your member of Congress.
You can always a stack on the table.
You can get it from your congressional office. Anyway, thanks for this opportunity. There are certain members of Congress that have always maintained a very close focus on Haiti. While it might not be on the radar of Congress as a whole, there is a group of members of Congress who really do care very deeply and passionately about Haiti and who follow it very closely. Many of those are on the House Subcommittee on Western Hemisphere Affairs, and after all of the storms, they held a hearing in September. And because I only have a couple of minutes to boil it down to kind of its most succinct elements, I think basically the two things that Congress were pleading for with the State Department representatives that were there and the administration were more money and temporary protected status. I mean, those were the two things that just really kept hitting on that would be very important for Haiti's recovery. Representative Maxine Waters has talked about wanting at least $300 million for increased assistance. When the continuing resolution was passed, it provided not less than $100 million for hurricane relief and reconstruction. But that's for Haiti and for other Caribbean countries, although you just said the majority of that is going to be going to Haiti. So you said it right.
Yeah. That's right.
But so that's, you know, that's a first step in providing assistance. A lot of members were very concerned looking at the response, the amount of money that was going to Haiti and comparing it to either Hurricane Mitch last time or what went to Eastern Europe. And there was concern about Russia going into Georgia, that there was a huge huge amount of money given there, and that the crisis in Haiti warranted, the situation there warranted funding more on that level than on the level that it was being given. In terms of TPS, the State Department said that it didn't want to, basically the same thing that it said in 2004, that it hadn't made a decision yet, that it did not wish to create a humanitarian disaster by granting TPS and then creating, you know, an impetus for people to leave Haiti. And so that they, you know, they're kind of not, were very wary of giving TPS. In response, various members said that they felt that if the devastation from the storms was not adequately addressed, there was a much bigger concern that there could be famine and widespread waterborne diseases. And several members said that they thought that would be a more likely cause of an exodus of Haitians than granting TPS would be. They also pointed out that the decision, ultimate decision, is of Homeland Security. Who was not at the hearing. With the new, you know, when there's a new Congress coming in, is Congress going to push TPS? I think they probably will, for the reason that Bob mentioned, that it does have benefits, it does allow them to work. It was given after Hurricane Mitch to Central Americans and has been very helpful in helping the flow of remittances back there and keeping people safe. Flow of immigrants not going back there. Right now, I think they haven't been pushing it as much, in part because there's almost a de facto TPS in terms of not the job benefits, but at least a suspension of deportation, so they're not sending Haitians back. I think Congress is going to be looking in the new Congress for new money, but not just for disaster relief. I think it's a much more of what people here have been talking about, a much more long-term look. They are not talking about, we just want disaster relief money, but they want it for reconstruction, they want it for long-term development, they want to include more continued disaster preparedness and mitigation. I think, I mean, it's hard to tell exactly what the cause was, but the thing I was struck at was looking at the extent of the damage after these storms and looking at the number of people that were killed and had an impact compared to previous storms, I was struck at how much lower the death rate was. And I, you know, think part of that could be that this was the first time that they had the Haitian government had an advanced warning system. It doesn't reach everybody because everyone doesn't have TV, doesn't have access to radio or different media that gave the alerts. But there is a beginning of a process. There was a warning. They did help that. So I think Congress is very interested in shoring that up and providing more such disaster mitigation assistance. And I think now is the time they're really trying to look creatively. I mean, the kinds of questions that we're getting, they're really trying to look broadly at all kinds of assistance that are given by all the different U.S. agencies, USAID, obviously has, you know, the most directed program and long-term development strategy, but also looking at DOD and the kind of assistance they have. And although there are concerns about, kind of long-term concerns about the involvement of DOD and military issues in Haiti, a lot of people point out that is where a lot of money is. So, you know, at least looking at it and wanting to look at that. But looking for other creative new ideas when you're doing reconstruction, talking about land use. You know, not building in floodplains, coming up with construction codes to help make construction make more sense in those areas. Things like Johanna has been encouraging, Jatropha, to help prevent erosion. So I think basically Congress is going to be looking for more money. What they are to provide more money, but they are looking for really creative solutions and long-term solutions that will help mitigate these disasters in the future rather than just responding to it as a crisis.
Thanks very much.
Oh, and I just wanted to also say other things like HOPE 2, and my colleague Jeff Hornbeck is here, and he had a report out on the HOPE 2 Act, which is very useful.
Okay. And where's Jeff?
Oh, there he is.
Okay. So, that's Jeff. I want to open the floor for questions. We have about 30 minutes left. On two things I want to ask. First of all, I want to explain that our rules are that these meetings are held on a not-for-attribution basis, which means that the comments here are on the record in the sense that we will publish, when this is over, a summary of the main ideas that were expressed, but no one will be identified by name, and so this allows people to say what they think without fear of being voted for. And the other thing is that I would like, when somebody's called upon, if they would just identify themselves before by name and institution. There are a lot of really knowledgeable people in this audience, and so we'd like to know who you are. Also, at the same time, one of the primary benefits of this group is the opportunity to network and to identify the people in the Washington community who are really interested.
Before I ask my questions for all of you, with the support of the Haitian Embassy.
Could you identify yourself?
Stanley Lucas, Washington Democracy Project. With the support of the Haitian Embassy, we have put a committee together to help Haitians and FedEx provided planes to, you know, to sneak into the Haitian. So if you contact the Haitian Embassy, they can provide the information. My question to Joe, do you think the U.S. government up to $750 per month can make remittances tax deductible for Haitians living in the United States sending money to Haiti? And my question to Mrs. Sikata, can you elaborate a bit about debt relief? There is a calendar, criteria, expectation from the Haitian government, and talk a bit about the accountability side. And my last one for Bob McGuire, Mr. Perry just said that you are very devoted, and sometimes so devoted, sometimes we think you are to regressations. My question is, we read your article in the Washington Post about fixed-off jobs. As you know, the country has 80% unemployment right now. We need everything that the country can get. And hope what was a good thing, and you were very critical of that. Why?
Sure. Want me to go? Stanley, good to see you again, by the way. Did I understand your question? Is it possible to deduct for income tax purposes remittances sent Was that the question?
We send $2 billion to Haiti every year, the diaspora, Haitian diaspora.
Yeah, yeah.
If you could make it tax deductible up to $750 per month like Cuba, that would help the economy of the country. That would be like $3 billion on a year basis.
Yeah, well, the Congress could do pretty much anything it wants with the tax code. I guess I would lead off with that. And here's a creative idea that members of the new Congress might consider as a way of increasing the flow of remittances into Haiti. Right now, I don't think there's any realistic possibility of it happening. But you know who the members are, and perhaps you could put forward that idea for their consideration.
I'm actually going to take the opportunity to correct something that Bob McGuire said. It is not accurate to say that the World Bank is not canceling Haiti's debt. Haiti is part of the Highly Indebted Poor Country Initiative and the Multilateral Debt Relief Initiative, under which it has already received debt relief and will receive full debt relief at completion point. So that's the first point. The second point is that this is part of a global architecture. It's not dependent on the bank. It's dependent on the bank's shareholders, of which there are 140. I personally, or Bob Zelig personally, cannot unilaterally cancel a country's debt. There is a system that was agreed on, which all the shareholders agreed on. In terms of actual relief, at the time of decision point, which is the first step in the process in 2006, Haiti's estimated HIPC debt relief was $140 million. And I'm going to get a little technical because people are mixing stocks and flows, but it was $140 million in net present value terms, of which the IDA portion, the World Bank portion, was estimated at about $53 million. Of that $53 million, we have essentially given all that relief except $9 million. We have reached the maximum that we allowed under the HIPC rules, which is up to 50% of the overall debt relief. So we have done that. We went for an exception for Haiti, which was approved by the shareholders. It's normally 33%. We went to the max of 50%. So that has been done. In terms of this year, and again, I just want to clarify this because I've seen all kinds of numbers floating around. The debt service scheduled for this year to the bank for the fiscal year is a total of $21 million, of which $17 million is amortization and less than $4 million is interest payments. So when people talk about, well, can't you cancel the interest payments this year, we're really talking about $4 million, for which we cannot do unilaterally, would have to go to the shareholders. And then you contrast that with the amount of money that we're giving through exceptional allocations, et cetera. Haiti's best chance is getting the full debt relief, which will happen. We expect the completion point in June. You asked whether we think we're on track. You also expressed, or I can't remember who expressed some concerns. I think we are on track. We had good discussions with the Haitian authorities during the annual meetings. We are very sensitive to the situation. There are some things that are a little bit beyond the control of the government. For example, if there's a law that you needed a parliament to pass, obviously we have to be sensitive that there hasn't been a parliament. So we're realistic, but we feel that Haiti is on track. It has done very well, not just as Haiti, but relative to all other countries in the HIPC basket, some of which have been in pretty dire conditions as well. And we expect them to get full debt relief in June of 2009.
Thanks very much. Tim?
That's the third question.
I'm sorry.
There was some.
That's the third question.
Yvonne, thank you for the clarification. I think that the concern is that between now and June 2009, there's a lot of urgencies in any available funds that can be channeled toward that ultimate. Stanley was mentioned that my fanhood or fanaticism is for a baseball team, but you're right, it is for Haiti as well. And I've always felt that it's in the interest of the United States to have a strong and healthy neighbor, and Haiti can certainly be that. In terms of the letter I wrote to the Washington Post, I'd encourage you to read it again. In the first sentence of the letter, it says that I believe that jobs are part of the equation, and hope is part of the equation. But in view of what I've given as the background to some of this environmental issue that is damaging, you know, so much in Haiti, I think that it's important to shift the paradigm or shift the narrative and focus on rural Haiti, which has been neglected for so long. So I'm saying to shift the emphasis. I'm not saying that hope is a bad idea, that these kind of jobs are a bad idea. But I feel that in the past, so much emphasis has been put on this, and other parts of Haiti and other parts of the equation have been neglected to the detriment of the health of the country. That's my argument.
Can we go over here?
Sure. Yeah. Dan Erickson with Inter-American Dialogue. I was in Gonaïves about a year and a half ago. I remember very vividly seeing all these houses that are being rebuilt in the floodplain. And as you know, Gonaïves has been hit by a major storm in 2004. They killed some several thousand people. And so my first question was there anything done after that to kind of address some of the issues you've laid out in terms of trying to move people out of the danger zones in the city? And why did that ultimately not succeed? And then just the second question is, we heard Ambassador Joseph's, I think, very poignant cry not just to work with NGOs in Haiti and to develop the government. I think everyone agrees it's important. But I think that Joseph would also probably concede, perhaps even Ambassador Joseph, that the government's capacity to implement is extremely limited in terms of the different agencies, and even President Preval has said this on multiple occasions, we have very weak institutions. And so my question, I guess it's primarily for Yvonne, but the other two panelists want to chip in, is do we have the right development models for Haiti, and what is the balance between working with a government with a very limited capacity to act and with non-governmental actors that perhaps can hit the ground running a little more quickly?
While you think about the answer to that, let me take two more questions and then we'll come back. Okay, in the back and over there in the corner.
Thank you. Kira Salva from the Brazilian Embassy. I was not going to speak, but just to address a comment by Mr. Tubman.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the signals we have from private investors, and this is private investment we're talking about, is that hope too is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot bring, for instance, cotton cloth from Brazil and turn it into jeans in Haiti and export to the United States. And it's very hard to convince private investors to come to Haiti when they can go to Guatemala or the Dominican Republic and get better conditions. So I'm not even sure if CAFTA DR parity is enough. Maybe you have to go to CAFTA DR plus. Just a little bit of a downer. But the other thing is, I'm also not sure, based on the experience of the last 4 years, that staying the course in Haiti, even for 10 or 12 years, is enough. We are actually just running to stay in the same place, and every 3 or 4 years a hurricane comes and blows us back to where we started. Maybe instead of staying the course, we have to change the scale. We have to take a commitment and multiply by 10. Instead of staying the course, we need a surge. A development surge, not a troop surge. maybe the third comment is that, I mean, about the development model that Dan was speaking about, I don't know if you have it. I don't know if you have the right development model. Maybe you should concentrate on doing three things: reforestation, power supply, and roads, and leave the Haitians to do everything else. And if you fix those three things, reforestation, power supplies, and roads, I think Haiti would be a different country. And fourth and last, do, as Ambassador Joseph said, do everything through the Haitian government. If you don't do it, you are not really helping the country. We cannot fritter the money away in the Republic of NGOs in Port-au-Prince. Thank you.
Thank you. One more question and then we'll...
Okay. My name is Tanya Escarne and I'm from the Department of State. And my question actually is tied to yours a bit. With the presence of Hope Act 2, I was wondering, has there been any discussion between the companies that are coming to Haiti about building from the ground up, and when they do so, expanding the electricity and the water services that they need for their own factories to the people within a local community that they're hiring as their workers?
Thank you. Let's start with Joe.
Do you want me to comment on all three?
All three. Take all the whole batch. Just, let yourself go.
Working through the government rather than, you know, I think it would be preferable. I agree, since we're not in an attribution situation, I agree with Ambassador Joseph. I think it would be better. But I think we also have to have a hard-nosed look at what the capabilities are and, you know, decide what it is you want more. right now, I think that the balance tips in favor of working with the available mechanisms to get the reconstruction started and deliver the humanitarian assistance, while perhaps adopting a longer-term view of institution building for Haiti's government to the extent that it needs it. That's a kind of a politician's answer, but you know, there it is. Yvonne, what do you think?
I think, look, we're going through an evolution. Certainly, the move to working with NGOs was a practical reaction to the capacity constraints on the ground. However, from the World Bank's perspective, we do think we need to work with the government of Haiti. And we were one of the first donors for our education project. We're working with the Ministry of Education. It's not easy, but we're there. And we're doing it, and, you know, we're learning about each other, and we're building capacity, we hope, et cetera. So I think you do need the balance. I mean, for example, some of the stuff we're doing on community-driven development, it's not through the government, but we feel that it's an important contribution in terms of building social capital in some of these communities. So I think the ideal situation is where Ambassador Joseph has pointed us to, which is fully working with the government. But I think there is a role, even in the case of governments that are fully capable, for NGOs and communities to have a role. And we're hoping that through our work with the Ministry of Education and this coming year with the Ministry of Agriculture, which will be the next core ministry that we're working with, that we're doing our bit to strengthen the capacity. So I take that point that is made. I just want to say that when we talk about staying the course, I'm not thinking about staying static. I mean, I think if you heard my characterization of the reconstruction needs, we are looking at, we need to all scale up. But I think I'm at the point of also encouraging all our partners, especially those who may not have necessarily worked in such a difficult situation, to say, look, we've been through this in other countries, and we know that it is daunting, but that we need to stay in and continue our support. Dan, in response to your question about Gonaïve, I actually don't know the answer. As you know, I'm relatively new to the Haiti team. I will say, and Ambassador Joseph is here, so I should let him take this question, that I think there are political difficulties in reassessing whether Gonaïve should be rebuilt. I think there's some very powerful senators and others from Gonaïve, so I think this is a political decision which goes beyond the capabilities of
very, very much unlike the problem we have in New Orleans, right? We don't have any political problems with that.
That's right.
You know that Gonaïve was the place where Haiti's independence was declared on January 1, 1804. So there is some sacredness, so to speak, about Gonaïve. That's the reason I said some programs to reroute the rivers should be done, and perhaps move part of Gonaïve to the hills, dredge the bay, and if we have to put up walls, it has been done in the Netherlands, why not in Haiti?
To the colleague from the State Department. What I do know is that ISP, our private sector wing, is working with the private sector and the government on industrial zones, and within those industrial zones, how they would provide the necessary infrastructure, electricity, water, etc. But that's actually been one of the constraints for investors coming in, is really finding those service factory spaces that they can come in and immediately. And this was something that the private sector raised last week when we were there.
Just real quick comment. Ray mentioned that there are two major cities below sea level. I would add, to make things perhaps a little worse, you know, much of the Port-au-Prince slums are just marginally above sea level. And Michel Pierre-Louis has said that, you know, the next disaster for strikes Port-au-Prince will make this look like a walk in the park. So we have to consider that as well.
Did you want to ask a question? Or do you You had your hand up, and I wanted to get you before you were going to leave.
Well, I wanted to talk.
Yeah, just one last thing. On the development model, I mean, Dan, you know, if we look at all the money that's gone in Haiti over all the years and we see the issues of today, I think it's pretty clear that there's a lot of flawed models out there. But it's very encouraging, I think, on two respects. One, people talking about changing the narrative. And I do think that Haiti, at least at present and hopefully into the future, you know, has partners in the public sector worthy to work with and need to be reinforced and strengthened.
Okay, let's take a couple more questions. We have about 10 minutes left. Do you want to go?
Let me just ask a quick question, and perhaps it might be the impolitic question, but nobody's mentioned the Dominican Republic. Haiti is not isolated on an island. There are two nations that share that. And I wanted to get a sense of, given the environmental vulnerability of the entire island, the fact that all the predictions and models for increased sea level, greater frequency of hurricanes, actually requires that we not only look at the crisis in Haiti, as drastic and terrible as it is, but we need to do a prevention model for the entire island to really change the dynamic. And I was wondering to what extent at the bank particularly, and maybe at the State Department, there was some thinking as we looked down the road that we could create a more proactive approach to what is clearly going to be an ongoing problem, not only for the United States, but the international community.
I'd like to introduce Arden Lang, who's here from the United Nations in New York, the Office of Peacekeeping, and I'd like to invite you to say a couple of words.
Sure. I'm over the Department of Peacekeeping Operations on the MINUSTAH desk. So, needless to say, it's been a busy couple of months since September, actually since April. It's interesting to note that sort of through our planning cycles, as we think about peacekeeping missions and their involvement in countries, we tend to roll out consolidation plans that think about how we're going to go about working ourselves out of business over the course of 4 to 5 to 6 years. And we've been in the process of doing just that over the course of the summer when these hurricanes struck. And I have to say that having seen a lot of the satellite imagery and reports coming in from the 10,000 police and troops that we've got on the ground, everything that the panelists have said, I think, I mean, I'm heartened to hear the silver linings behind their evaluations, and it's encouraging to hear the dedication and expressions of hope on part of institutions to get back into the rebuilding and reconstruction game. But there definitely is a feeling on the part of our house that something very significant needs to happen in terms of getting back into Haiti and reconstructing the basic infrastructure that will allow the country to continue economic development along the path that we were witnessing in the first quarter of 2008, if the stabilization process is to remain on track. And it's not immediately clear listening, so far to what I've heard today, that whether or not we were concerned a little bit about whether or not a business as usual approach is going to solve this problem. I mean, it's something that President Preval has said to us a couple of times, that it may be time for a game-changing initiative where we're looking at the type of response we saw to Mitch, the type of response we saw to the tsunami disaster in Indonesia and elsewhere, where there's a real unified effort to stand behind the government of Haiti and that the normal traditional models of disaster assistance and long-term reconstruction become unified under a more centralized leadership. And whether that comes from within the UN system, whether that comes within from the bilaterals, that's an open question. But I think we really are at the cusp of a moment of opportunity where if we don't seize it and look forward to trying to organize the international community and its intervention over the next 5 to 10 years in a new and different way to help Haiti build back better, we run the risk of allowing Haiti to fall back off of the radar screen. And purely from a institutional perspective, you know, the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, which had hoped to look at downscaling rather sooner rather than later, as John said, in the next 4 years or so, that perhaps would be there for longer than need be. We hope to turn over much of the severe responsibilities to our Haitian counterparts.
Thanks very much. We have about 6 minutes left. I'm going to let the panel respond. Starting with Yvonne, and we'll go from there.
I'm Johanna Mendelson, Foreman, CSIRO.
Thanks. I think your question is really timely. A couple of things. At the request of the Dominican Republic government, we are doing a piece of work this year that's going to look at the island as a whole. We're now in discussions with both governments on what they want to focus on. Climate change is one of the areas that we've seen. The other is labor markets, et cetera. So it's precisely the sort of thing. And part of the reason they got interested in this is we did something with avian flu. So we have something in the DR and we have something in Haiti, but it's the same person in the bank who's doing both of them there. He's just retired, Jean-Claude Bacouet.
Yes.
So he's just retired now. Someone will be taking it over. So we do see that we need to look at the island as a whole. As you probably know, it hasn't been easy in the past, particularly on the DR side. But there is an opening now. They had expressed this interest before the election, and they reaffirmed it since the election. So we're moving ahead, and we expect that within the course of next calendar year, we will have a piece of work that will talk about areas where we can work more closely together, but also, and not just on the climate and the environment more generally, but on the climate, have some very specific actions as we're doing with adaptation in some of the other Caribbean islands.
I can tell you, just briefly, that from a political point of view, President Fernandez in the Dominican Republic is well aware of the fact that Haiti and the Dominican Republic share a common destiny. If only because of the people who, Haitian folks, who appear at the border and end up being in the Dominican Republic. And, I think everybody in the room understands the dynamic that's involved there. It's not a good situation for Haitians in the DR. It is an issue that we raise with the Dominicans from time to time. And after the hurricane struck, the Dominicans were there with some assistance.
Among the first.
Yeah, with heavy equipment and some other things. So I think the political awareness is there. That's the basic.
Well, I want to add something here.
Sure.
You know, now we are I heard the word caste mentioned many times. Mm-hmm. President Fernandez has some personal relationship with President Preval.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've known each other. And President Fernandez in New York had a lot of connections with Haitians. So he does understand. But, you know, I was born in Dominican Republic
mm-hmm.
of Haitian parents. But I didn't have a birth certificate until I went to Haiti.
Okay.
So there's there are the political questions that we have to address. And there are so many thousands of Haitians in the Dominican Republic, you understand that. But if they were not there, the Dominican Republic would not have a sugar industry.
Mm-hmm.
And
so
now
you can see the dependence. There is an interdependence.
So we ought to build on this, on the past, to and take the advantage of the leadership of the two countries now to try to work towards something. There's a film out in which they did ask me, what do I see? I say, I see the future brighter because I see new generations of Dominicans and Haitians who are willing to work on common solutions. And I think we should encourage it.
Bob, no comments.
No comments.
Senior fellows at USIP always have comments as part of your contract.
Let's get some more questions. Then we have time for questions.
We have time for one more question. If somebody has a burning desire there yes, please, go ahead.
My name is Ashika Damodar. I'm with Free This Voice. And I'm interested to know your thoughts on the issue of promotion of human rights in the context of development. Do any of you have any thoughts as to the rest of that system and how, you know, whether trafficking of children is increasing after the hurricanes and what is being done to address this as we're, you know, developing our development plans.
Gosh, I don't... the immediate answer, I don't know whether there's been any kind of increase in you know, the trafficking of children under that system. I can say, as a government, we're well aware of it. We raise it every year in the human rights report. But as a cultural institution in Haiti, I think it's a very difficult problem to try to address in a way that takes care of or acknowledges everybody's concerns. Yes, it's an issue for us and remains an issue.
I will respond.
Yeah, please.
You know, since ABC had its big story on Haiti, where this producer was leaving Manhattan, and in 10 hours he was going to buy a child in Haiti. And when he, I think that's what has brought all these things about Haiti. And when he goes to Haiti, you see him in a hotel, I know the hotel, you see him discussing and negotiating, and I'm waiting to see that the deal is cut. The deal is not cut. So, and I was waiting to see how that child was going to, what document that child would have, and how that child was going to go through customs, how it would come here through Homeland Security. This was not shown. But he turns around and discusses the problem of Rest Avec. And he tried to say that Rest Avec is a slave. However, again, he undercuts what he says. Because when the families of the Rest Avec find out how the Rest Avec was being treated, they went and got her away. So I'm not saying it's a proud tradition for Haitians. But as long as poverty remains where it is in Haiti, you will have families in the countryside always trying to get their children to work for people or to live with people in the city that they expect will send to school. Sometimes it works. And so this brush that Haiti is involved in slave trafficking of children, I say is a lie.
Well, I think we are now at an end. I want to thank you all for coming. I want to remind all of you there are several publications that are on the table outside too that have been brought by our panelists. Another one, USIP has issued a new report in September 2008. It's on the UN campaign, Central UN campaign against the gang in Port-au-Prince. So I suggest you pick that up as you're leaving. We will be in touch through the next public forum sponsored by the Haiti Working Group, and we look forward to seeing you there. Thanks so much again for coming.
Thank you.